Good evening, everyone. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and I welcome you to the New York Society Library. For those of you viewing or listening to our program on the internet, yes, we're now doing our events on the internet. Welcome to 79th and Madison in New York City. Tonight we have a very special program, but I just want to remind you of a couple of things. Our events calendar, which we issue periodically, this is the most current issue, and we have a new one that should be out shortly and in your mailboxes at home or pick them up downstairs. We do rely on the support of our donors to help make evenings like tonight possible, and I want to take a moment to thank all of our members who help every year with the annual appeal, and this year's annual appeal is, need I say it, a very important one with the economic climate. We do appreciate all the support of our members, and the funds that we realize every year do help the library do everything from build collections to have programs, provide services, and most importantly, to keep staff in the building. Our speaker tonight is a dedicated library member of the Society Library, Frances Kiernan. Ms. Kiernan is a former New Yorker editor, and she's also the author of Seeing Mary Plain, A Life of Mary McCarthy. And her most recent book, which she'll be speaking about tonight, is The Last Mrs. Astor, A New York Story. It was once said that Brooke Astor's life was a story out of Edith Wharton. After the death of her beloved husband, Charles Henry Marshall, after whom our rare book reading room is named, she wedded Vincent Astor, who died in 1959. As many of you know, in a highly publicized courtroom battle, Mrs. Astor fought off an attempt to break his will, which left more than $67 million to the Vincent Astor Foundation. Mrs. Astor came into her own as the foundation's president, using his legacy to benefit New York City in a variety of creative ways, including support of many institutions, the public library system, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and yes, the Society Library that you're in tonight. Mrs. Kiernan's definitive biography of the fascinating Brooke Astor has been well received by the press. The Atlantic applauded it, saying, "This sympathetic telling of Mrs. Astor's story should counterbalance all the gossipy sensationalism." After the event, we will have books for sale outside, and I believe Ms. Kiernan will be more than happy to meet you and sign copies. I want to thank our audio team for this evening. It's an audio team of one, Mike. And I hope you enjoy the program. Please join me in welcoming Frances Kiernan.
Thank you, Mark. I have a tiny cold, so I may sound a little funny. I also want to thank Sarah Holliday, who took me on a tour of the Charles Marshall Reading Room, which is a reading room that is used by anyone who wants to do research on a book that is a rare book and can't be taken out of the library. And what I love about that reading room is it reminds me of Mrs. Astor. It's cozy, one of her favorite words, and it's also attractive, another favorite word. Instead of a library table, it has a dining table with pedestal, has very pretty curtains, has a mantel, a fireplace, it has a pretty secretary, and built-in bookshelves, and it looks like it could be in someone's home. And it also looks like you might want to spend a lot of time there. And she was married to Charles Marshall for 20 years, and he was the love of her life. He was her second husband. She met him at the end of her first very unhappy 10-year marriage to Dryden Coosar. She was married early on, 19, sort of married off by her mother for money. She married a rich man's son, and it was not a happy marriage. He did abuse her. He broke her jaw when she was pregnant. He also was a bit of a womanizer, a gambler, and a drinker. And with Charles Marshall, she found true happiness. And I would like to read a little. If you go upstairs, what you would see is a plaque, and it says the Charles Henry Marshall, and it has his name, and it was given to the library in 1984, this room. And I would also like to say, this was not foundation money. This was Brooke Astor money. Brooke Astor was always very careful to keep her donations separate from the foundation donations. In fact, when she would do charity balls, she paid for the tables out of her money. It was never foundation money. She was very careful to keep the two apart. But its description of Charles Marshall is a man who in his busy life always found time to read. Then the president of the club wrote a longer piece about him at the time, Arnold Whitbridge. And he said, among other things, he was the most unassuming of book lovers. He was a modest, hard-working student, not what one thinks of as a scholar. And then Charles Marshall was called Buddy Marshall by his friends. He was very beloved. He was the president of the Brook Club. He was a very attractive man and a very wise man. And what they say there is Buddy always gave of his best. He always had a book in hand, and he enjoyed a good novel or biography. What it doesn't say is Buddy Marshall also was a bookbinder, and he was part of the Lennox family, and he inherited from his father a very fine collection of books, not all of them in great shape, and he learned how to work with leather and also with library papers to bind books, and that's what he would do when they were up in the Berkshires. It was one of his hobbies. And so it seems only fitting that he would be acknowledged in a room up where old volumes are being rebound and cared for. And it would be typical of Brooke Astor to find a place that would be perfect for what she wanted to do in acknowledging him. In 1984, she was giving the foundation, and she was always careful to say it's the Vincent Astor Foundation, not herself, was giving millions to the New York Public Library and turning it around. And I think she felt that her beloved Charles Marshall should have a place in a library as well, and she found, I think, the perfect place for him. And I would like to say, I didn't do all that much research here for the Brooke Astor book because I was concentrating on her foundation work, so I was going out and interviewing foundation people. But when I was doing my Mary McCarthy book, I practically lived in this library. It is the most wonderful place to do research. And also you can go in the stacks. And I was saying to someone, I have a very happy memory of having Henry Cooper and Hoyt Spellman help teach me how to use one of the microfiche machines. I think it's a great resource and a great place to be. Now, many people ask me, how can you go from someone like Mary McCarthy, who took no prisoners, who had a slashing wit, and was not exactly a polished social person, to Brooke Astor, who did not say bad things about her other people, who was generous in spirit, and how can you go from one person to another? And I would say they had many friends in common, and so there must have been some quality that they shared. And some of the friends they had in common were Robert Silvers, Renata Adler, now my mind is going to go blank. Actually, Mary McCarthy, and she met a couple of times as well. And Jason Epstein, who said of Brooke Astor, she was a really good writer. What kept her from being a great writer was she wasn't mean enough. She wasn't tough enough. But she really is a good writer. And I would say one of the things that drew me to her was her writing. It's funny. When she died, many people said she was a socialite. But in fact, she wasn't really just a socialite. I think she will be remembered forever as being a philanthropist and a very innovative one. And that is what I was trying to show. She was a hands-on philanthropist. She was someone who believed you should go, you should see, you should follow the organization, and then if they were doing good work, you would give them more money and back it up. She was not someone who delegated. When she inherited the Vincent Astor Foundation, she was 57 years old. And I like to think of that because that's when her real life began. She'd already had three marriages. Two of her husbands had died, one had divorced her. And it was 1959, and it was a time when most women are thinking, well, I'll give up my tennis and I'll start playing golf, or, you know, I won't do this or I won't do that. And here she's embarking on a whole new adventure, and she had a fabulous time doing it. The other thing I like about her is not only did she do good work, but she also managed to have fun. And she managed to somehow combine her social life and her philanthropy in a way that made it fun not only for her, but for other people. What particularly draws me to her is her frivolous side, which Mary McCarthy also had. And someone said to me once of Mary McCarthy, life was more vivid when you were in her company. It was like living in a novel. And I think the same was true of Brooke Astor. They lit up a room when they walked into it, and they lit up a room when you were with them. They were good company. And I think they brought a lot of imagination into the way they lived. And I think also with Brooke Astor, she wrote two wonderful memoirs, and one of the reasons they're fun to read, she has a voice, and you feel like you're in her company. And so for me, it has always been a pleasure. In fact, it occurred to me the two women I wrote about had written very good memoirs, and which I relied on heavily. And so I guess that would be another uniting quality they had. But what made Brooke Astor, I think, particularly special, I think both and Mary McCarthy, is they seem to invent themselves. I never could see a predecessor for Mary McCarthy as a kind of glamorous, sexy intellectual and novelist. And for Brooke Astor, there was nobody who preceded her. She may have been the last Mrs. Astor, and I think she will be, even though there are other Astors. But she was nothing like the first Mrs. Astor. She was somebody who was out and about. Some people have said she was the first person to use publicity in a modern way. Certainly she was very aware of publicity. But what I think I love about her is her personal touch. When she inherited the Vincent Astor Foundation, Vincent Astor actually established it in 1948, and it was for the alleviation of human misery. Well, that is so amorphous. I mean, what do you do with that? And it was a pretty bare-bones operation. He had nothing to do with it, really. He had Cardinal Spellman on the board, his Dr. Connie Guyon, and a few other people. And he had a director who would also be someone who was working for him. And he would give away, a few hundred thousand every so often. I think by the time it closed down, they may have given away $5 million. When it closed down would have been in 1959 when he died. So the course of 11 years was a rich man's way of giving money. He took a little interest, but he really left it to other people to make decisions, and money went to New York Hospital or the Astor Home for Boys up in Rhinebeck. It's not, and the Red Cross, things like that. When Brooke Astor came along, and suddenly there was an infusion of about $67 million, she decided she was going to not just let Alan Betts, who was then the director, run the foundation. She was going to take a hand. She was going to run it personally. And then she went to the Rockefellers, which she often did. She went to John D. Rockefeller III, and she said, how do you do this? And he was the one who said to her, the person who gives away the money should be the person who makes the decision and also the person who goes and sees. Well, it suited her perfectly. She was a woman who loved to go and see. And so that is what happened. Then she had another idea. She decided to focus. $67 million in 1959 was quite a bit of money. It's certainly more than it is now. But it was nothing compared to what the big foundations had to give away. This was not the Ford Foundation or the Rockefeller Foundations. And she decided to get the biggest bang for her buck. She was going to focus it. And she decided the Astor money had been made in New York, mostly in New York real estate, actually, and sometimes with tenements. They were slumlords. And she decided the money would go back to the people of New York. And so that's what she did. And so her two touchstones were we go and we see, and we focus on New York. When she started out, the director of the foundation had no interest in having her take charge. I think he was looking forward. Money is power. And so she was going to have, whoever ran it was going to have a lot of power. And I was very fortunate in having Tom Coolidge to consult with. He had been a young man and acting as the secretary of the foundation when Brooke arrived, and he had actually been there under Captain Astor, and because Captain Astor was very fond of being in the Navy, he was very proud of being in the Navy and also of his yachts. He didn't have them at that point, but he still, in fact, the foundation offices were furnished from his last yacht. He had taken the furniture out of it and put it in a corner office. And Tom Coolidge was able to describe, he was there from the very beginning of Brooke's time to the very end, and he was able to describe to me what happened. And so at first she had a board that was not particularly sympathetic, and gradually as people retired, the board changed. And she said, and what Tom Coolidge said to me was, there was never a confrontation with Alan Betts, but gradually he came to know that he would do well to resign. And so he did, and she took over. And she did it indirectly and in a most feminine fashion, but she did it firmly. And then once he had resigned, and another person came for 2 years and didn't work out, somebody suggested to her she might do better working with a woman. And so that's when Linda Gillies arrived. Linda Gillies is someone who made this book possible. She worked with Mrs. Astor from 1974 until the foundation closed in 97. And Linda was no more experienced than Mrs. Astor in philanthropy. She'd gone to Sarah Lawrence, had a degree in art history, had been working at the Met for Jacob Bean in the rare drawings and prints section, and then had realized she did not have curatorial interests, had briefly worked with Philippe de Montebello when he came from Houston, came back to the museum, and everybody who worked with her knew she was wonderful, suggested to Brooke this was the person for her. What Linda said to me is, because we would have many morning meetings in the apartment, we'd have breakfast, and she gradually told me the whole story of working with Mrs. Astor, and I love to hear it. They ran it as a very feminine foundation, but she said the first thing that Mrs. Astor asked her was, how much do you expect to be paid? Linda had no idea, and certainly at the Metropolitan Museum, someone like Linda did not get much money. And so she suggested two figures, both of them way higher than anything. And she said immediately Mrs. Astor chose the highest figure. She also told a story of a few years into working with Mrs. Astor. She came to the office one day on a Tuesday, and Mrs. Astor said, you look dreadful. What's going on? And Linda said, well, Arch and I have been painting the apartment. She said, you shouldn't be doing that. She said, let me pay for that. And that was Brooke Astor. She was very practical, and she was very generous. So what would happen was Linda was at the offices. The offices, which I did get to see, were a corner office on a floor that the Astors had. It had nice light because it had southern and western exposure, but it was just an office, not particularly large. And they had a partner's desk, and it had some a sofa or two. As I said, it was furnished with prints and with furniture from Vincent's yacht. It had, with Linda and Mrs. Astor, there was a secretary, there was a bookkeeper, and a messenger, and that was about it. It really was not like going to the Carnegie Foundation or anything else. And they kept expenses low. What would happen is people would apply for grants, and Linda would go over the grant applications, and then she would put together a folder of several and then go over them with Mrs. Astor. Mrs. Astor would come to the office once a week or twice a week. But often what Linda would do is, the offices are on 54th Street, and they are on Park Avenue, and they were right by Kenneth's, so Mrs. Astor could have her hair combed out, or she could have her hair colored. When she was having her hair colored, they spent a lot of time going over various brochures and all the research, the applications. Then they would go out, they would choose three or four, and they'd go out with a car and driver, and they would go and they would see. And what Linda said was they'd get back in the car after a visit. Sometimes they'd have tea, they'd meet with the people, and these were the ones that Linda had screened. She would think Mrs. Astor would find them sympathetic. And she said mostly she guessed right, but not always. And she said afterward they'd get in the car and Mrs. Astor would say, "Did you see the book on the desk? Did you see this? Did you see that?" And Linda said she just never missed a trick. And she was very practical-minded, and she was very observant. And so the next thing they decided to do was there would be three board meetings a year. And again, the foundation wasn't like most foundations. Board members were given $10,000, but it was not to pocket. They were allowed to give $10,000 to their favorite charity. And again, this is not customary on most boards. They would meet three times a year, and it would be about 4 in the afternoon, and some of the men would be a little tired. So Linda and Mrs. Astor decided, because there was no big boardroom with a table, it was in that office. And Mrs. Astor would be sitting behind the partner's desk. Some of the men would be in club chairs, and some would be on sofas, and some would doze off. And so they decided to serve tea and little sandwiches from William Pohl and to have cookies. And if only to balance their teacups, the men had to wake up. And it worked marvelously. But as I say, it was a woman's organization. It was very personal. Sometimes after they had gone on one of their 3 or 4 hour visits to various organizations, Mrs. Astor would say, "Let's stop at Bergdorf Goodman," and she'd buy something for herself and then buy a scarf for Linda. So it was fun to work for Mrs. Astor, and it was never the same. And I guess that's why I, who have not that great an interest in philanthropy, was very drawn to Mrs. Astor's philanthropy. I think what you see now is people following her model more. People who don't just delegate their giving to a professional, who take a more hands-on approach. When I was going around talking about this with various people in the city, I said, "Who do you see as being most like Brooke Astor?" And more than one person said, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, if he does retire as mayor, he plans to give away money, but give it away in a hands-on way. You could sort of see it with the Gateses. It has become a model for a way of giving. What was interesting was, Mrs. Astor, you probably all saw pictures of her in the Sunday Times dressed up, because Bill Cunningham loved to include her. He almost, if she was in town, you would see a picture of her. Also, she would go to 3 or 4 events a night sometimes, so she was bound to be at some place where he'd be. But the thing about Mrs. Astor was that she, whenever she went, she made it so special. She made it something you would want to do. And so she drew other people to her. And this is the thing. Last year, our mayor gave away $200 million. Well, that's more than the Vincent Astor Foundation gave away in its whole time. So it really was not an organization that gave away, big money. But what she also did was she attracted money. When she served on many boards, the library for one, the Metropolitan Museum. Thomas Hoving said her greatest gift to the Metropolitan Museum was in the 70s, she realized new money was going to have to be brought in. It was a rough time in the city, perhaps like a time we're going to face now. And she would give dinners and cocktail parties. And she would invite people who had never been invited to join the Metropolitan Museum of Art's board. And she would introduce them to each other. He said what was amazing is she knew everyone's name, everyone's interest. He said she had the natural gifts of a politician. And so she was transformative in boards as well as in, because people wanted to join and be with her. And they wanted to have some of the fun she appeared to be having. She was the first woman to join the board of Rockefeller University. And the man who had been the president when she joined said her, the first thing she did was she asked if the gentlemen would forego their cigars from now on because it was a little tough. And she stayed on the board almost to the very end, would always ask sharp questions, and always want to see experiments, even if they were a little bloody or whatever. Nothing surprised her. The other thing she did was, if she had an organization she was backing and giving perhaps $10,000 to, it was like a seal of approval. She, and a good housekeeping seal of approval, she and Linda did good research. And so they rarely made a mistake. And so other organizations that didn't have the time to do as much research would just come behind her and give money. And so a grant from the Vincent Astor Foundation was terrific, even if it wasn't for that much money. The other thing she would do is she had very rich friends. And if she was behind an organization, she made sure that other people knew about it. What's interesting to me is that many of her gifts were about people, not about art, let's say. In fact, she was very active at the Metropolitan Museum, but the most memorable donation was when she closed the foundation. She endowed a Christmas party for the entire staff to go on in perpetuity. She was a woman who knew the name of every guard and didn't forget them, and also knew about their families. And it was interesting to me, Vartan Gregorian had said to me, Mrs. Astor was very egalitarian, and it's true, she knew and liked people from every walk of life. But as I talked to other people, and I think it was Douglas Dillon who said this, he said it wasn't truly that she was egalitarian, it's that she thought everyone was of equal interest. And that's something different. This is not a philosophy. It's just the way she lived. Everyone was equally interesting, and she was curious. And I think that's one of the reasons people warmed to her. She would go out in her hat, her white gloves, her beautifully tailored suit, her good pin, her pearls, and no one felt it was like Lady Bountiful. One woman said to me, she made you feel as if you were doing her a favor. You were letting her help you make something better. And that's an important attitude or way to suggest what you're doing. I should also say, in 1967, she became involved with Bedford-Stuyvesant. And Frank Thomas, who was head of the Bedford-Stuyvesant Corporation, told me that what she did there was amazing, and it may have been the beginning of the Brooke Astor we know. It was Bobby Kennedy who talked her into going out there. Bedford-Stuyvesant had lovely housing stock, but it was just a terrible area for crime. It was the pits. And she and the foundation gave money to create a neighborhood center and a park. But what they were also trying to do was to get the people who lived there, who owned houses, to participate in good garbage collection and renovating those houses, and they were giving matching grants. But not everybody wanted to do this because it was going to cost them money. And the young people in the area, they got to help do the work, so they were offering jobs as well. It was sort of a grassroots, hands-on way of doing it. But to convince the ladies, and it was mostly the women in the neighborhood, that this is something to do, they would meet in various houses at night, and there would be a group, probably not this large, but something like this. And they would talk about what was going on, and then people in the audience could ask questions. Mrs. Astor, again, came all dressed up, and she would speak sometimes, or sometimes she'd just sit and listen. And I said to Frank Thomason, didn't anybody look twice at her or what was going on? He was the first person who said this. He said they saw her being dressed that way as a sign of respect because this is the way they would dress to go to church. And instinctively, she understood that. She understood many things instinctively. She was a very smart woman, but she was also a very wise woman. And I think what also made it work, and this is where I have trouble capturing something. She had enormous charm. She was just somebody who could charm you. And so I'm going to read a tiny bit from the book because it describes my first meeting with her when she charmed me. And I'm hoping that by doing this, I can suggest to you what it was like to experience Brooke Astor. We had a friend in common, John Hart, and John brought us together. I was finishing my Mary McCarthy book, and there's a terrible period when your book is about to come out when you're a wreck. There's not much you can do, and you're at loose ends. If you're a very disciplined person, you've started your next book, but if you're not, you haven't. And Brooke Astor had been doing pieces for Vanity Fair on manners. John had this idea, because he knew I'd been an editor at The New Yorker, that I could help her, that I would help her put together a book, and then we would work together. And so that was the reason for this lunch. And it was to be at the Hotel Carlyle. And lunch was set for 1, and I made sure to arrive early. It was a typical first week in January. Outside, it was cold and gray with a hint of snow in the air. But as I approached the steps that led down to the restaurant, the first thing that caught my eye was an enormous spray of crabapple branches and quince. Once the maitre d' learned I was part of Mrs. Astor's party, he ushered me to the best of 4 horseshoe-shaped banquettes that backed onto this extravagant floral tribute to spring. If I looked to my right, I had an unimpeded view of the entrance. Mostly I studied the menu, but occasionally I would glance up and see some well-dressed couple being led past me to a less desirable table. At precisely 1:15, Mrs. Astor entered the restaurant on the arm of John Hart. You couldn't exactly say she made an entrance, but when she appeared at the top of the short flight of steps leading down from the vestibule, all eyes turned in her direction. Some of this had to do with the way the maitre d' fussed over her ever so slightly, and some of it had to do with what I think of as star power. And then part of it had to do with the way she was dressed. By the time John Hart had gotten the 3 of us settled, with Mrs. Astor in the middle, I'd begun to covet everything she was wearing. The smart Loden-colored felt hat, the pretty green silk blouse, the green windowpane plaid suit, the triple string of gumball-sized pearls, the diamond starburst on her left shoulder, and the jade and diamond earrings that set off her green eyes. I had been prepared to admire her, but I hadn't been prepared to find her pretty or chic. Photographs didn't begin to do Mrs. Astor justice. Part of what made her attractive was the delicacy of her coloring. Part of it was the way she brought all her attention to bear on the person she was talking to, and part of it was the magic worked by charm. She was an accomplished seductress. That day, whether to please John Hart or for want of anything better to occupy her, she set out to seduce me. Nothing she said was especially witty or insightful. Indeed, I'm not sure I'd remember any of it if I hadn't written up some notes that same evening. But at the time, everything she said seemed delightfully fresh and candid, remarkably so when you considered that she was 97 years old. That day, whatever Mrs. Astor ordered from the long menu, I ordered too. I think it was a crab meat salad. Neither of us paid much attention to our food. For one thing, I don't think she had much of an appetite. Contributing to the stylish impression she made was the fact that she was impossibly tiny. For another, she had trouble hearing. John had made sure that I was seated on her right by her good ear. But even so, I had to speak up and sometimes repeat myself, and she had to bend close to make out what was being said. Mrs. Astor led off by asking about my time in The New Yorker. At lunch that day, she did her best to put me at my ease, the way any experienced older person does with a younger person who is shy. When conversation flagged, she simply asked me another question. It was a method I had myself used many times. We talked again about The New Yorker, which had just published 3 of her poems. Then we talked about her dear friend Brendan Gill, who was on the board of this library for many years. Then Mrs. Astor brought up someone we knew in common, an old friend of hers who had recently married a woman half his age. She made no bones about what she thought of his wearing blue jeans for the wedding ceremony and his going around beforehand saying he wasn't sure he wanted to go through with the whole thing. That led her to talk about her own terrible first marriage. She wondered why it hadn't left her embittered. She seemed bemused by the fact. She spoke of her honeymoon, of the groom's not having a dinner jacket so they could go down to the main dining room, and of his going down alone to the bar only to come back drunk. But that was only the beginning. Some 6 months later, when they were up in Maine, she had terrible abdominal cramps and assumed she was having a baby. But when the doctor examined her, he determined she was still a virgin. She told me that the first American president she ever met was Harry Truman, and her favorite was Ronald Reagan. On occasion, the Reagans would have her stay overnight at the White House. He was fun, she said, and Nancy was strong. She said she'd gone down to the Clinton White House the year before to receive the Presidential Medal of Freedom. This led her to a discussion of Clinton's being caught in a lie about Monica Lewinsky. She was reminded of the time she'd been caught in bed by her mother with chocolate smeared on her face and had been foolish enough to try to deny it. Lying is not efficient, we agreed. You can't keep track. It was amazing that we covered as much ground as we did, given that we were constantly interrupted. One after another, people came over to the table and greeted Mrs. Astor with the assurance of long-lost friends. One or two said something about not seeing her picture in the paper in the Sunday Style section over the holidays. Sometimes they invoked the name of a mutual friend or an upcoming benefit. Always Mrs. Astor would lean forward and profess herself delighted to see them. Never did she show any sign of discomfort or confusion. After, she would whisper to John and me, "I have no idea who that was." After lunch, John and I walked Mrs. Astor home. In the restaurant, Mrs. Astor had relied solely on John's arms for support. But for the four-block walk to her apartment, she used an ebony walking stick. Our pace was slow as we headed down Madison Avenue with Mrs. Astor in the middle. There was no wind, but the air felt cold and raw and unwelcoming. Over her suit, Mrs. Astor wore a beautifully tailored loden coat and a honey-colored fur scarf so full and soft it could only be sable. A few people smiled as we passed, but no one stopped. At one point, after we had walked a couple of blocks, Mrs. Astor paused to show us a gift shop where she'd found most of her Christmas gifts that year. Next door was a Christian Science reading room. We were about to start on our way again when a young woman suddenly rushed out from the reading room and dropped to her knees on the sidewalk at Mrs. Astor's feet. Except for the fact that she was wearing no coat, she appeared to be a perfectly ordinary young woman. Before long, there was a cluster of people around us. Unfazed by the cold pavement or the gathering crowd, the young woman proceeded to tell Mrs. Astor how much she had always meant to her. Mrs. Astor leaned forward ever so slightly, as if to better hear what was being said. Not once did she blanch or recoil or act as if this incident was in any way remarkable. When the young woman had finally said her piece, Mrs. Astor gently but firmly patted her shoulder and said, "Thank you, my dear." It was like being with the Queen Mum or the Pope, at once totally out of the ordinary and totally in control. No mention was made of the incident. By the time we turned east toward Park Avenue, I was starting to wonder if our own parting might be in any way awkward. I needn't have worried. When we arrived at the entrance of her apartment building, Mrs. Astor asked how she could get in touch with me. Only as I was entering my address and phone number in her little red pocket diary did I realize that we had never once discussed the possibility of my working with her. As we said our goodbyes, Mrs. Astor said what people say at such moments. Taking my hand in hers and looking me straight in the eye, she said that she had very much enjoyed meeting me and hoped to see me again soon. Then, as we were about to part, she seemed to say something totally unexpected. I think we're going to be good friends. Later, I remember thinking, well, maybe yes, maybe no. But walking home that day, I had utter faith that we would be spending many happy hours together. Well, I never heard from her again. But it didn't surprise me. On my way home from 73rd and Park, I stopped here. And I got out her two memoirs and her two novels. And I read each memoir in a day. And what I discovered was some of her best stories she'd already put in books. And I also discovered she was a perfectly, really quite accomplished writer, and she didn't need my help at all. And that seemed to be the end of it. We saw each other a couple of other times for lunch. I would also say I was looking for another subject for a biography, but my Mary McCarthy book was 845 pages long, and Mary McCarthy only lived to the age of 77. And I didn't want to write another long book if I could help it. And I thought Mrs. Astor was getting toward 100, and I thought, this is never going to work. And then what happened was 9/11, and I had done enough reading from the time at the Society Library to know that she was perhaps at her best, and somewhat like the Queen Mum going in the east of London after the Blitz. She was wonderful at that point, going around New York, giving money to the city when it was very much needed, looking well-dressed, looking optimistic, saying things that showed there were hope. At that point, she did one thing that I particularly like. The Underhoving, the Metropolitan Museum, had begun to stay open Tuesday nights for working people. And when city money dried up, that was no longer possible. And she funded those Tuesday nights with the Vincent Astor Foundation, which I think was quite a terrific thing to do. When I was talking to Felix Rowatin, he said, you know, it wasn't really the money she gave. It was in some ways like Paul Moore, who urged people from the pulpit of St. John the Divine, business people, not to leave the city, to keep their offices in the city, not to desert the city. He said she was a symbolic figure, but symbolic figures count for a lot sometimes. And so I think that was her great moment. And that's when she decided also, with the approval of her board, to spend down capital, to not just give away the interest from the foundation, but to give sizable chunks of money away to the city, to Central Park, which was falling apart. She was instrumental. She hired Betsy Barlow Rogers to teach young people how to work in the park during the summers. And Betsy Barlow Rogers told me the head of the parks at that time was not enchanted with what she was doing. And he began to withhold her money. It was the foundation's money, but he was withholding it. And so she finally told Mrs. Astor, because she needed the money to live on. And she said Mrs. Astor got all dressed up and marched down to his office and confronted him. And he came up with the money. And so she was like that. Felix Rowatin told me a story that I think has its symbolic meaning, too. He was meeting her for lunch one day downtown at a French restaurant they went to often. And she was late, which was not her custom. And this would have been the early 80s, late 70s. And he couldn't understand what was going on. Finally, she came in, and she loved to walk. One of the reasons she knew Central Park was in trouble was she would walk her dogs in the park. She would walk down Park Avenue. Many people have told me of running into her when she was walking. So here she is, and she comes in, and those white gloves are filthy. And he said, Brooke, what's happened to you? And she said what had happened was, as she was walking down from her apartment, she had come upon a man who was trying to turn off a fire hydrant that some kids had opened. And she stopped and asked if she could help him, and he handed her some of his tools, and that's what had happened. So she was not, you know, she would get her hands dirty if it came to it, certainly her white gloves dirty. Anyway, that was the Brooke Astor that charmed me. She was a complicated woman. She certainly was not perfect. I think whenever you do a biography, you learn perhaps a little more than you might want to know about your subject. But I had to conclude at the end, she really was terrific. She was a unique figure, and she brought a lot of imagination to both her life and to New York. And so was why, finally, it was fun to research her life and also to write about her. So I thank you. Okay. Now, I'm wondering, do any of you have questions? I'm sure you do. Does anyone want to raise? And would you please stand up and speak loudly, because like Mrs. Astor, I'm getting a little deaf. Well, it's interesting. No, she did not come for money. She came from a middle-class family. Her father was an officer in the Marine Corps. He had gone to Annapolis. The Marines are part of the Navy. That's where they began. They were people who were on board ship, and they would do the fighting. And so his father had actually been an admiral. So she, on her father's side, she came from generations of military people, professional soldiers. On her mother's side, her mother's father was a lawyer who came from England, actually, and very bookish. Her father was very disciplined, and because of her father, she led a very interesting young life. Father had a house in Washington. Her mother's family was in Washington. Parents met in Washington. But because the father was attached to various foreign legations, she lived as a young child in Hawaii, in Panama, in the Dominican Republic, and in China. She writes very eloquently in Patchwork Child about this childhood. And she also talks about how she was an only child, and so had the love of two adoring parents. They were adoring, but the father was very busy, and her mother was busy with her social life. And she ran a salon, actually, in China. She was a great flirt. I would say Brooke's flirtatious ways and her love of clothing came from the mother, and her discipline came from her father. It was an unbeatable combination. And so she then, at about age 12, was settled in Washington. Her mother, who was very ambitious socially, and they didn't have all that much money. She went to Miss Madeira's school, and her mother took her out of the school for a couple of reasons. Brooke had said she would like to learn Greek. What she didn't tell her mother was she wanted to learn Greek to impress an older man. But in any case, her mother did not want her to become a blue stocking like Miss Madeira herself. Brooke loved, there's a charming interview that she did in her 90s about her time there. She said, we all worshipped Miss Madeira, who was still quite young then, used to go around with a long hanging skirt and tennis shoes, striding through the halls, and then they would have a convocation every morning. So she was very much a hands-on headmistress. And her mother didn't want Brooke to grow up to be like Miss Madeira, who had gone to Vassar. So she took her, she thought if Brooke was a blue stocking, and Brooke was not a great beauty, she never was. She was very attractive. She learned to make herself more attractive with time. But her mother felt she wouldn't be marriageable. So Brooke Astor never finished high school virtually. She never finished secondary school. And as a child, she had her companions were her dogs and her books and the servants. And I think in a way that was part of why she found everyone interesting, because her company was the chief houseboy in China. It was her nanny in Haiti. It was not her mother. And so and some people, when you throw children into the hands of servants, it's a mixed bag. Sometimes they can be abused. She was basically lucky. And so she had a great admiration for these people and felt comfortable, always at ease with them. It's funny, when I was talking to Nelson Aldrich, I said she was a middle-class girl. And he said, no, she was a daughter of the professional classes. But I think, for all intents and purposes, she was a middle-class girl who married well. All three times, she married rich men. The first husband, Dryden Coozer, it was new money. It was slightly vulgar. She lived in Bernardsville. Second husband, Charles Marshall, the Charles Marshall of the reading room here, was a very different kind of man. He was beloved by everyone. He came from an old New York family. And in fact, his family, several generations back, had founded the Black Ball shipping line. And now it seems perfectly logical, but in those days it was innovative. What they would do is they would have a ship in Liverpool and a ship in New York, and the ships would depart on schedule with their cargo, whether they were full or not, and they would cross in the Atlantic. Until that day, ships did not leave unless they were full of cargo. And so it was one of the innovations, turning this into a great port. And so that was the kind of family she came from. Her second husband came from, and she was proudest of that family, more so than of the Astors. And I think part of it is she really loved Charles Marshall, or Buddy. Any other questions? Yes? As a socialite, she was a woman who led a life in society. I think Alexander Isles said to me during the Klaus von Bülow scandal, her mother had been Brooke Astor's best friend, Mab Moltke, and she said it was not a good time for her. And she had testified against Klaus von Bülow. She had a young son. She was in the process of divorcing her husband, who was supportive, but people were shunning her. And she said Brooke would invite her to her dinners, put her arm around her, and make sure that everyone knew she had Mrs. Astor's backing. And that, I guess, is what a social arbiter does. She could make you, I don't think she went out of her way to break you, but if she wanted to take you up, you were blessed. Does that help? Okay. Anybody else have a question?
Yes.
Could you stand up, please? Brooke Astor had only one child, and there's a confusion here because his name is Anthony Marshall. But indeed, he was born Anthony Couser. And when he came of age, he was never adopted by Charles Marshall, the beloved second husband, for reasons that had to do in part because Charles Marshall had a family of his own that he had to leave to marry Brooke Astor, and his son was somewhat damaged. And I think he would have been hard-pressed to adopt a child who was not damaged, another son. And so, but he was a good stepfather, and Tony loved his stepfather. And when he came of age, he did he wasn't even of age. He decided, I think at 18, to finish school, drop out of school, join the Marine Corps. He was at Iwo Jima, where he was a hero and decorated and wounded. And he also changed his name officially to Anthony Marshall. But he was not adopted by Charles Marshall, and he was not his son. He just took the name. It was a reverse form of adoption in a way. He adopted Charles Marshall. Any other questions? Could you stand up? All of her personal possessions, unless they were bestowed upon someone specifically in her will, all of her property goes to her son, always did, no matter which will. So the estate in Westchester, Holly Hill, goes to Tony Marshall, and she signed over the property in Maine before her death to Tony. And the apartment belongs to him. And these are not part of the general estate. These are separate. And I think the apartment is up for sale. And it's my understanding that Holly Hill will be up for sale, too. The neighbors are very upset. It's a large property, and they do not want it subdivided. It's in Briarcliff Manor. And so it may take a while before all of that is resolved. But I don't think there'll ever be a place where you can visit her artifacts. One friend has said that he would very much, there was one room, her homes were never grand. They were comfortable. They looked like a wealthy woman's home, but they could be shabby. I remember going into her drawing room with her secretary one time and noticing her ceiling was peeling more than mine was. And when I came back and told my husband, he said, we better do something about our ceiling. And I think they did about theirs. But they were lovely. They were always lovely. But there was one room that Albert Hadley did for her, the beautiful red lacquer library. And more than one person has said it would be lovely if the person who, if whoever buys the apartment donated that to the Metropolitan Museum. It is a beautiful room. Almost as beautiful as this room. Okay. Any other questions? Yes. Well, that's a funny question, because until I read her memoir, I didn't know there was such a thing, beagling, which some of you probably know what that is. It's a form of fox hunting, but you do it on foot, and you run around, and she even had a smart outfit she wore, and she was very athletic always, and they met beagling, and then you do this in the brisk fall air, and you run in the hills, and they were doing this in New Jersey, and then afterward, you all gather at someone's house, and you have delicious sandwiches and tea, and she loved having tea. Many of the times I was with her, we were having tea, and that's how she met him. And he was married, and she was married. And interestingly enough, she was in this miserable marriage, but it's the late 1920s, and she doesn't have money of her own. She's living a luxurious life, so it's comfortable on one level, although she's not happy. But nobody was getting divorced back then, and her parents were not encouraging her. Her father at that point was high commissioner in Haiti. He had actually been promoted, so her parents were not around. And she stayed in that marriage. And what happened was Dryden Coozer's father died. And he took this opportunity to divorce her. And so she was freed from the marriage. And then her father came along, as she describes it, and said, you must not see Buddy Marshall, Charles Marshall, while you're a single woman. He's a married man. She came to live in New York. She lived on Gracie Square for about a year and a half. And Charles Marshall decided to leave his family and marry her. And that's how it happened. Yes?
Why didn't he leave her money? Apparently, Buddy Marshall, this paragraph, did not leave her money. Did he leave her money?
Well, he felt very responsible for the family he left behind. Also, by the end of the marriage, after World War II, he simply didn't have as much money as he'd had, and Brooke went to work. And that's one of the reasons I think she was good at running the foundation. She was at House and Garden as a features editor. It was her job to get her society friends to let House and Garden photograph their houses. And it was also her job to run photo shoots, and she did writing for the magazine. She did that for many years. The same time, Buddy Marshall left a will. He was always paying alimony. But in his will, he left his wife virtually the same amount of money as he left Brooke. So when everything was cleared away, and I actually got copies of the will and all the other documents, she, if she had an annuity, was going to get, you know, if she put the money that she was going to be left in an annuity, the wife, his first wife, was going to be paid quite a handsome sum monthly until she died. But Brooke, if she had an annuity, would get $25,000 a year. Well, in 1952, which is when he died, that was a sort of substantial sum. But she knew about inflation, and she also knew that this was not what was, this was not how her life had been led for a long time. And within a few months after Buddy Marshall died, she met Vincent Astor. And within a year, less than a year, she married Vincent. She writes about it quite eloquently. He meets her at a dinner party. He and his wife, Minnie Cushing, are not happy together. Minnie wants out, but Minnie would like to have a replacement. She feels she'll get a better divorce settlement. And so They invite her up to Rhinecliff, to their house. Ferncliff is the house which is in Rhinebeck, for Memorial Day weekend. She goes and he proposes marriage. What she was not aware of was Minnie had invited three women up, and she was the second choice. And the first choice was the widow of a good friend of Vincent's, Janet Rhinelander Stewart, her picture is in my book. I was fortunate enough by accident to meet her daughter, who told me the whole story and said there were times when she wished her mother had said yes. But Vincent proposed marriage, and Janet Rhinelander Stewart was more beautiful than any movie star. She was just exquisite, and she was funny, good company. And so Vincent proposes marriage, and he promises her she'll have $2.5 million settlement upon marriage, which is what Brooke got, and then she'll have this, she'll have that, and she can run the foundation. And he says to her, my doctors say I have only about 3 years to live. And he had very bad emphysema. He had bad vascular problems, and he really was not in good shape. And she turns to him, and this is famous comeback. She says, but Vincent, what if the doctors are wrong? Well, she had enough money that she could afford to say that. And they were wrong. He lived another 6 years, and Brooke put in some hard times. The picture on the jacket of the book was taken when they had their party at the St. Regis roof to announce their wedding, after their wedding. And he owned the St. Regis, and that was it. He did give a party for Louis Auchincloss, because when he married Adele, just because Brooke forced him to, but he hated doing it. They never went out for dinner. His idea of a good night was to sit home with the dogs and Brooke and have her play the piano and sing and tell stories, and that was her life, more or less, with him. It was not what she was used to with Charles Marshall, when they were one of those attractive couples who everyone wanted to have for dinner or to a party. So she put in 6 hard years, and then one can understand why, as soon as Vincent died, she couldn't wait to go out 3 and 4 times a night. And she did. Any other questions? Well, thank you.
Thank you all for coming, and Ms. Kiernan will be available for signing books here in the library. Thanks.